This hour's top stories, a top U.S. general says Iran possesses one of the most capable militaries in the Middle East and its missile force is the most formidable in the region. Dozens of Palestinians are injured as Israeli soldiers and settlers attack protesters angry at restrictions imposed by Israel during the holy month of Ramadan. Also ahead, Pakistan's parliament is set to resume debate about the expulsion of the French envoy amid public anger over Islamophobic measures in France. Welcome to the program. Head of U.S. Central Command Kenneth McKenzie says Iran possesses one of the most capable militaries in the West Asia region. McKenzie was addressing the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. He said Iran's offensive capabilities include nearly short and long-range ballistic missiles, as well as an array of land attack cruise missiles. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region. On Tuesday, McKenzie testified before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. He said Iran's widespread use of small and medium-sized drones means the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Iran has time and again stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats. Well, let's discuss this a little bit further with Mr. Jason Andro. He's a political commentator who comes to you via Skype out of Ontario. Jason, tell me your understanding of this, and why do you think he had to actually go and address the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee with actually commenting on Iran the way he did?
I think that his decision to address the public version of the government the way he did was, I think that he has a growing concern. He wouldn't have done this unless he felt that there was some kind of threat to U.S. hegemonic power in the region. So I think that what he's doing is he's sending a message to the U.S. government that they're not prepared to deal with the missile technology that Iran has right now. And I think that that's basically what he's saying. They have to have a countermeasure for it. As we saw previously after the assassination of Soleimani and the missile strikes that took place in retaliation, the United States was not in any position to stop them whatsoever. They were completely vulnerable to those missile attacks. And I think that that has something to do with it. There's been a lot of talk in the United States about defunding the military or shifting a lot of the funding away from the military and towards things that people need, like healthcare and education. Now, this is still pretty much, in my view, a pipe dream, but something that I would think that a lot of the war hawks inside of the government and the Pentagon would be worried about happening. Now, I think that this is also a product of the ongoing situation between the two countries. To me, it's very clear that the United States is trying to instigate Iran further by not returning to the JCPOA that they could do overnight, easily, and return. And I think that's very much tied up with the fact that this is about intimidating Iran and trying to force them to make a certain decisions, force them to make certain concessions which are unnecessary and frankly unethical in this situation, and allowing Israel a free hand to do damage, etc. So I think what they're really saying is that he's saying that there's a vulnerability in U.S. power. Now, we do know previously, in 2002, there was what was called the Millennium Challenge. It was a military simulation done between U.S. Navy forces inside the Persian Gulf against Iran. And in those simulations, every time, the United States lost the battle. Now, this is going back, quite a long time now. This is going back almost 20 years. Now, obviously, missile and rocket technology of Iran has significantly improved since then. I think he's sending a message that they're not prepared for an actual military confrontation. I think that the main obstacle is Iran's ability to launch missiles and rockets as a form of self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Jason, there is also the timing of this. I was just thinking that maybe, perhaps, he's trying to send a signal to their negotiating team in Vienna that basically these days they go back and forth to Vienna to discuss the JCPOA, that, hey, you guys, if you want to discuss something with the Iranians, there is this area of their air superiority as well. Maybe try to include that in your negotiations with them. Do you think this might have a little bit of an implication towards that matter?
I think it might definitely be that way, too. I think this could also be a signal to the negotiation team to say, to bring up the issue of Iran's missile technology in terms of negotiations, rather than just simply returning to the agreement as they should, and Biden previously said that he would. I think that some of the new conditions that they're trying to force on Iran may include missile technology, reduce the ability of Iran to use missiles to defend itself in case of an invasion, even though it's already been highly recognized that the missile technology is not against the law. It's not against domestic law. It's not against international law. This is something the United States would want to undermine Iran's ability to defend itself. But the main goal, allegedly, was to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of Iran, which would be absolutely devastating for the United States if Iran actually got a hold of them, which they have. Iran's made very clear that it's not a goal that they have. However, the missile technology is proving to be a major obstacle as well. And part of the previous JCPOA agreement was to perhaps undermine Iran's ability to develop that kind of technology by harming the economy, but that's not taken place. So I think that this might be a signal to the forces to start bringing up Iran's missile technology in terms of agreements that could be made with the new JCPOA.
Now that he's speaking publicly about this, I wonder, Jason, if he's sending any signal to other regional countries as well.
Yes, I think that's probably a very good possibility, too. He could be signaling to Israel to bump up its missile defense technology, could be sending the same message to Saudi Arabia. Hey, look, they have this capability, and if something were to happen and a war in the region breaks out, this would be an advantage that Iran has, and that you need to start planning to make sure that you can deal with this in the case that this, God forbid, turns out into like an entire Middle Eastern war. So I think that there's a good chance that they're sending that message to their allies there as well.
All right. Many, many thanks. That's Mr. Jason Andrula. He's a political commentator who came to you live via Skype out of Ontario. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, injuring 105. That is according to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. It says 20 have been hospitalized. Israeli forces arrested nearly four dozen Palestinian demonstrators. They were protesting restrictions on their gatherings in Jerusalem Al-Quds' Old City during the fasting month of Ramadan. The Palestinian prime minister has condemned the violence as institutionalized terrorism of Israel against Palestinians and their sanctities. Mohammed Shtayeh said such acts of aggression are aimed at Judaizing Jerusalem Al-Quds. He called for the international condemnation of the Israeli violence. The latest clashes came after videos posted online showed Palestinians being harassed Wednesday night by Israeli youths shouting, quote, "Death to Arabs." The UN has called for all eligible Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds to be able to vote in the upcoming Palestinian parliamentary elections. A UN spokesman said it is very important that Palestinians in all parts of the occupied territories are able to participate in the democratic process. European members of the UN Security Council have made the same call. Meanwhile, Palestinian envoy to the UN, Riyad Mansour, has urged countries to press Israel not to block elections in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Palestinians will in May hold their first legislative elections in 15 years. Officials fear that thousands of them in Jerusalem Al-Quds may be unable to vote as the process there requires a green light from Israel. The Yemeni army says it has conducted retaliatory drone strikes on targets inside Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Seri said two Qasif 2K drones attacked the King Khalid airbase in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Mushayt. He added that in a separate attack, a Samat drone targeted a facility belonging to Saudi Arabia's oil company Aramco in the Jizan province. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have escalated retaliatory attacks in recent months. They are pushing for the lifting of a blockade and the cessation of aggression that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. Edward Corrigan is an international lawyer and commentator. He believes that Yemen is acting well to defend itself against the Saudi war that has created the world's worst man-made catastrophe there.
All of these attacks are illegitimate, and of course the Saudi intervention into Yemen also is illegitimate. Now, the Saudis have been relentlessly bombing, you know, every day, but usually it's civilian targets, you know, and infrastructure, hospitals, schools, food protection facilities, even, you know, the Yemeni government based in Sana'a, you know, retaliating in a way that they can. And they're targeting military facilities and oil infrastructure, which I think is legitimate. And for the most part, I've not heard of them targeting strictly civilian areas. The other point of note is that the Saudis seem to be almost totally unable to stop these attacks, whether by predators or by drones or by missiles. And that is a point, even though the Americans and the British are helping the Saudis with missiles and stuff, so sometimes they do stop them. But for the most part, no. They seem to be able to, the Yemenis seem to be able to target any, place at will, and are very successful and have been very pinpoint in their target, defending it. So Yemen has, even though it's a poor country and it doesn't have anywhere near the technology that the Saudis have, and the Saudis are buying them from the United States and Britain and France and other countries, but they have put up a tremendous fight and have adapted incredibly and have created their own indigenous, military infrastructure with drones and missiles that they can strike back at the Saudis almost at will.
Pakistan's parliament will resume a debate on whether to expel the French ambassador over the blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Lawmakers will hold the debate following a resolution that called off recent anti-France protests in Pakistan. A protest last week turned violent, leading to at least a dozen deaths earlier this week. The government reached a resolution with the Tahrik-e-Taliban, or I should say Tahrik-e-Labbaik Pakistan, the TLP. That's the party that organized the rallies and called for the expulsion of the French envoy. The TLP waged its anti-France campaign months ago. It did so after the French government defended a satirical magazine to republish the Prophet Muhammad's cartoons. France's move drew strong criticism from across the Muslim world. Javed Rana in Islamabad says lawmakers affiliated with Pakistan's ruling party are under pressure to vote in favor of the expulsion of the French ambassador, as doing otherwise might cost them the next elections.
The ruling party, which obviously doesn't want to want the expulsion of the French ambassador, but there are lawmakers and they understand the cost of opposing such move, because they know if they oppose the expulsion of the French ambassador, this could possibly cost them the next election. And even now there have been protests against the interior minister, who was in one way or the other he was in charge of the part of the security operation against these protesters. So these lawmakers are already losing public support. They are quite under pressure to expel French ambassador, despite the fact that the government had a lot of manipulations not to do so.
China has strongly condemned a British Parliament motion that called for an end to, quote, genocide in China's Xinjiang region.
The unwarranted accusation by a handful of British MPs that there is genocide in Xinjiang is the most preposterous lie of the century, an outrageous insult and affront to the Chinese people, and a gross breach of international law and the basic norms governing international relations.
The Chinese embassy in London called the British motion a blatant interference in China's internal affairs. The embassy urged Britain to immediately right its wrong moves. UK lawmakers introduced a motion on Wednesday. The British government has already imposed sanctions on some Chinese officials over the situation of Muslim Uyghur community in Xinjiang. The lawmakers want ministers to go further. Britain, along with the US and EU, accused China of human rights violations against Uyghurs. Beijing strongly denies it. Hundreds attend the funeral of African-American Daunte Wright, who was fatally shot by a white policewoman in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Top state politicians and relatives of George Floyd, another black man killed by the Minnesota police, attended the service. A 20-year-old Wright was laid to rest following a public viewing of his casket. Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton made a speech at the funeral, slamming what he called the stench of racism in the U.S.
Well, we come today as the air fresheners for Minnesota. We're trying to get the stench of police brutality out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racism out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racial profiling out of the atmosphere. We come to Minnesota as air fresheners because your air is too odorous for us to breathe. We can't breathe in your stinking air no more.
Sharpton said the police must understand they are not above the law. Wright was shot at a traffic stop in Brooklyn Center on April the 11th. The police say the officer mistook her handgun for a taser. The black man's death was one in a growing list of instances where African Americans are being killed at the hands of white police officers. The death of Floyd in Minneapolis in May of last year sparked a wave of protests against police brutality and racial profiling in the U.S. And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be a verse.
وَالَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 18 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
فَهَلْ يَنظُرُونَ إِلَّا السَّاعَةَ أَن تَأْتِيَهُمْ بَغْتَةً فَقَدْ جَاءَ أَشْرَاطُهَا فَأَنَّى لَهُمْ إِذَا جَاءَتْهُمْ ذِكْرَاهُمْ.
Do they await anything except that the hour should overtake them suddenly? Certainly, its portents have come. Of what avail will be their admonition to them when it overtakes them? If you might recall, in our explanation of the preceding ayahs of this surah last Friday, we presented to you glimpses of the rewards reserved for the believers in paradise and the miserable fate of the disbelievers in hell. We also said, those receptive to the words of God acquire sincerity of heart, peace of mind, and positive behavior at home and in society, while the heedless ones, including those who do not contemplate when listening to the recitation of the Noble Quran, do not gain anything. Thus, the heavenly scriptures with emphasis on monotheism, morally upright way of life, and the certainty of the day of resurrection for the final judgment are the true guides for humanity rather than any man-made schools of thought. The ayah that we recited to you now refers to the disbelievers and the heedless ones who, because of their lack of belief in the day of resurrection and judgment, waste their time and thus lose opportunities for repentance and reform. oblivious of the fact that the end could suddenly come before they could realize. The Arabic word sa'a in this ayah means the hour, and is usually used in the sense of resurrection, but it may also indicate divine wrath and annihilation of the disbelievers in this world as a prelude to the torments of resurrection for the deniers of truth. The next part of this ayah speaks of portents or signs of the coming of the fateful hour, when many could be caught unprepared. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is reported to have said, "Should I inform you of the portents of resurrection? They are negligence in establishing the daily ritual prayers, following vain desires, cherishing the wealthy and exchanging religion for worldly possessions. As for those who say they won't believe in the Day of Judgment until they see it coming, these doubters could be likened to a patient who illogically questions the diagnosis of a physician and refuses to take the prescribed medicines by saying, 'I cannot believe my condition could lead to death until I see the approach of death.' Such an irrational person ought to realize that when death strikes, no medicine will be of any use. From this I will learn that, number one, disbelievers and deniers of the Day of Judgment waste the opportunities of respite that God has granted for repentance and self-reform because of their self-deception and intransigence. Number two, there are ample proofs and signs all around us in the world of nature of the certainty of the Day of Resurrection, but only the seekers of truth realize these facts without any negligence or wasting of opportunities." Now let us listen to ayah 19 of this surah.
فَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَاسْتَغْفِرْ لِذَنْبِكَ وَلِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتِ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مُتَقَلَّبَكُمْ وَمَثْوَاكُمْ.
Know that there is no God except Allah, and plead to Allah for forgiveness of your sin and for the faithful men and faithful women. And Allah knows how you move about and your abode. This ayah commands the steadfastness on the right path, since there is no God except Allah, the one and only Creator, whose protection we owe to seek and to whom we turn in earnest for forgiveness, without the least fear of the enemies. It stresses that whenever the believing men and believing women err or commit a fault, they should seek forgiveness from the All-Merciful. Even the prophets, who by nature are infallible and thus sinless, used to seek the forgiveness from the Lord Most High as a sign of their humbleness. It was the habit of the Prophet of Islam to beseech Allah for mercy and the forgiveness of the faults, sins, and shortcomings of the believers. According to a statement from the Prophet, among the best forms of devotion are recitation of the phrases, Astaghfirullah means, "I beseech Allah for forgiveness," and La ilaha illallah, which means, "There is no God but Allah." Towards this end, the ayah means to say that nothing is hidden from the Almighty Creator, who is fully aware of all our movements and what we do in our abodes. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, the basis of all overworlds and deeds is monotheism, or the oneness of the Almighty Creator, rather than relying on fluctuating powers of fellow human or fearing them. Number two, The faithful men and women are included in the Prophet's supplications to the Lord Most High for forgiveness, as well as their health and purity of spirit. And number three, the Prophets and the Imams, though infallible by nature, are in need of divine favors. Now let us listen to Ayah 20 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
وَيَقُولُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَوْلَا نُزِّلَتْ سُورَةٌ فَإِذَا أُنْزِلَتْ سُورَةٌ مُحْكَمَةٌ وَذُكِرَ فِيهَا الْقِتَالُ رَأَيْتَ الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ رأيت الذين في قلوبهم مرض ينظرون إليك نظر المغشي عليه من الموت فأولى لهم.
Those who believe say, if only a surah were sent down for jihad, but when a definitive surah is sent down and fighting is mentioned in it, you see those in whose hearts is a sickness looking upon you with the look of someone fainting at death. So woe to them. This ayah refers to the tough conditions the Muslims face during the first few years of the advent of Islam, and means to say that because of persecutions by the Arab pagans, they would ask the Prophet whether a divine commandment for jihad had been revealed. But when a surah categorically and decisively commanded armed encounter to repel the aggressions of the disbelievers, some of these people, at the prospect of a battle, would become horrified and almost collapse out of fear. The true believers, however, would stand steadfast on the battlefield and fearlessly long for martyrdom, while the hypocrites who paid only lip service to Islam would be scared to death and run away. Thus, felicity lies in obedience to Almighty Allah, whose commandments ought to be carried out without the least fear. This ayah teaches us that, number one, there are many who make loud claims but retreat at the time of action. Number two, as the religion of mercy, Islam commands tough measures against the oppressors, including the armed fighting to repel their attacks. And number three, fear of defense against the enemies or fleeing the battlefield are signs of hypocrisy and lack of firm faith.
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the motto of France is freedom, liberty, and fraternity. Many French would say that there is a major gap in the slogan of the country and reality on the ground for its people. This as the French National Assembly has passed a new security law giving police even more power. One of the most controversial parts of the law prohibits the sharing of images of police with the malicious intent. Now, critics say it is vague and can be used to stifle freedom and initiate a more severe crackdown. We're going to start off this discussion crossing over to Paris, joined by correspondent there, Chris DeHaan. Chris, well, fill us in on what this law could mean.
Well, concretely, this law means certainly a limitation of individual and public liberties. So the police impunity will increase, that's for sure. Police powers are increasing, that's for sure. Now it will be interesting to investigate the exact degree of the limitation of these freedoms, because France is still not a police state. There are still democratic institutions functioning, political parties, associations, trade unions are working, but it's not sure in what kind of degree, what degree demonstrations, for instance, will be allowed in the near future. So it's certainly a limitation of public liberties, but we are not yet in a dictatorship.
And let me get our next guest in, too, on this independent journalist, if I have him out of Marseille, Sylvain Marcadia. Your take on this. In your opinion, why has the Macron government pushed for this? They were very aggressive in wanting to make sure this legislation gets passed.
Yes, it's a good question. Like, I really believe that the party in power, Macron's party, La République En Marche, is trying to attract voters who would vote for the far-right party, Rassemblement National, headed by Marine Le Pen. So this move that is basically supporting the actions of the police, supporting the impunity of the police, is a move to attract these conservative votes in favor of Macron for the coming elections next year. So I do believe that this is one of the objectives. The other is also to reassure the police in a moment where it is becoming like a key element of the French institutions. Like the public opinion is more and more engaged against the government. We've seen the Yellow Vest movement erupting a few years ago, a few months after Macron was elected and after his first policies. And this is a way to support, reassure the police in their actions against these movements that are opposing the power, the party in power, I believe.
Okay. Let me welcome my next guest out of Paris, journalist and geopolitical analyst Gerard Coleman. Gerard, good to have you with us. Your take on exactly what this means now. I mean, has France transitioned? Is it leaning more and more to the right and just continually trying to limit individual freedom? Because we see this particular law, the security law. We also have seen the separation law. Your assessment of what is going on in general in the country?
Well, it's been leaning to the financial rights since the 1960s, really when the Rothschild Bank took over, particularly in the 1970s. So the trajectory of French politics from the late 60s to now has been towards the extreme financial rights. Socially, in terms of social mores, the regime in place is essentially a consequence of 1968. So that's what goes for the left today. I don't really know what you would call that in terms of right or left. But I think the reality is that we have a police state, and now they're giving police full powers. So we have a situation where drones, for example, can go into people's houses. Police can use drones. They did use them in the lockdown last year. They used drones in different parts of the country, but that caused controversy. I mean, it was a lot of people were opposed to the idea of being followed around by drones, police drones. Now it will give police those kind of powers. We did see massive police brutality and repression during the Yellow Vest uprisings. We've seen massive police brutality right throughout the lockdown period over the last year. Just the other day in Paris, people were hunted out of parks and hunted out of the Seine area where people used to have picnics. People are not allowed to live effectively anymore in France, and that's not an exception, that's all over Europe. It is illegal to meet people, it is illegal pretty much to do anything other than go to work, wear a mask, and so on, and come home. So what it means is that it basically gives the police now possibility of following you around the drone, openly surveilling the whole population. And also, you know, private life is gone. They can legally go into your home. They have some suspicion about you. Now, suspicion about you might be that you're not wearing a mask in your home, if they make that the next law, which they could, because they're pretty much most of the time now here, when you read the newspapers, every day a new law is being passed, which takes away some other fundamental human liberty. So they spend most of their time discussing what liberty they're going to take away next. And so if you were to look at Paris now, particularly since the attacks in 2015-16, the series of terrorist attacks, it's police state, there's police everywhere. And, you know, if you compare it to so-called totalitarian countries, let's say like Iran, and I've been there many times, you don't see the same police concentration in the streets. This is a police state, and people of the police, if you ask here about the mask issue, for example, wearing masks in the street in Paris, I mean, some people believe in that and they comply, but a lot of people don't like being forced to do things. And most people I've spoken to said they wear them because they fear the police. Mm-hmm. So that you have a situation where people live in fear of the police all the time. Generally, the population in France is really very, very sick of fines. They get fined for being here.
Okay.
Speeding fines, with the sort of Internet of Things coming in, everything is being surveilled. So, you know, got sensors everywhere picking everything up. Now you're going to have biometric cameras. So, you know, that means that essentially you're under surveillance all the time. And,
okay. Stay with me, Gerard. Let me get Sylvain back in this discussion. Sylvain, you heard what Gerard was saying. Do you think that the majority of French people actually support these new security measures?
I don't think so. No, I really do not believe they do.
So why has the French Assembly? I mean, they're supposed to be representatives of the French people. So what has happened that this legislation then has been passed?
Well, this probably has to do with like the French particularity in politics, that even though politicians get like elected and voted for, they seldomly respect their promises once they get into power. Macron was never elected to vote these laws. Actually, there are many parts of his program that he never applied or delayed. And he has used the COVID-19 crisis very conveniently for this. And this is basically, yes, like the reason why the Assembly managed to vote this law. And I generally also believe that the establishment, the political establishment that voted this law is afraid, has learned the lessons from the Yellow Vest movement, feared for the stability of their well-being and everything, and they are ready to ensure that the status quo, like the Fifth Republic, as we are we call our institutions, are going to be maintained. And that actually have many issues that should be discussed in order to eventually come out of this system that is very vertical in terms of power, gives a lot of power to the president, and amongst other many other issues. But the representative system of France has issues that should be addressed instead of giving more rights to repress demonstrators and people opposing the police, which is actually a fundamental right.
Okay.
To demonstrate. This is a right that's being denied little by little, as mentioned.
Okay, well, Gerard, where does the press fit in here? I mean, will they be able to show images from the scene of demos when police are involved, or where do you see things going from that perspective?
Well, the press is a system of state propaganda in all Western countries, and it's always been like that. So the press the press is the state, really. There isn't a separation. There's very little criticism allowed of state policy in the press. The press is there as a communication device of the state. So it's not going to affect the working of journalists, because they mostly publish fake news anyway. And the demonstrations that will be allowed, the demonstrations that will take place, will be demonstrations which are state-sponsored. So, for example, climate change demonstrations are given full support of the state, full support of the banks and the corporations. Gay pride is fully supported by the corporations and banks and the state. All these kinds of demonstrations will be promoted, but real demonstrations will not be allowed, and we're going to see a criminalization of the type of Gilets Jaunes protests, the anti-mask protests, the anti-forced vaccine protests. There haven't been many in France in comparison to other countries, but this will make it more difficult for people with real issues, real life issues, to demonstrate. And the press doesn't cover those issues anyway, so they're not going to be concerned about the repression of the real dissidents in the country. We've just seen a dissident released from prison today. Hervé Vessel was put in prison because of his writings, and so now we have political prisoners in France, and we have more prison sentenced prominent dissident intellectuals, and that's the future. They're actually emptying a lot of the prisons. They're letting prisoners, actual criminals, go, and they're filling them with political dissidents, and that is the future right now.
Well, Sylvain, now officials say that the law is needed to protect law enforcement officers. Your take on that side of things, what do you think?
I'll use a quote from David Dufresne, who is a French journalist who has been writing extensively on the Yellow Vest movement and on issues of global security in France and freedom of speech, and he was calling this law Orwellian, even in its name, global security. What security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of the citizens, or are we talking about the security and impunity of the law enforcement forces? So, obviously, there is an issue with these laws, and they are definitely not a move in favor of freedom of speech. They are actually a deterrent for independent journalists to engage in their work and to document the actions of the police. The issue here is police brutality. The issue is not security of police officers. There have been so many cases of police violence documented by citizens in the streets, and this is what the police and Gérald Darmanin, the Ministry of Interior, are trying to go against with this law that is basically giving this impunity and preventing citizens of doing their work, which is to report police violence and other actions during demonstrations.
Well, Gerard, we've also witnessed so many different laws. One of them is the separation law in France, where Muslims have been the target. We're just seeing more and more and more laws that seem to be weeding away the rights of the people in France. I'm just wondering about the French people in general. The French people have more of a love for independence and individual freedom. Why aren't we seeing more of a reaction? We have seen some demonstrations, but do you think that we're going to see increased outward show of being upset to this new law by the French people, or have they just learned to acquiesce and accept it?
There's two points there. You mentioned the Muslims and then the French love of liberty, and I think one on the Muslim issue, the police in France are highly integrated with the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad, the even Israeli militia like Fatah, who are banned, are so extreme they're banned in Israel. They have links to the French police. So that would explain focus as well on Muslims, because the constant obsession about Muslims in France, the danger and so on, and then many very suspect terrorist attacks. and enforce a catastrophic foreign policy. None of that is ever discussed in the debate. So that, you know, that is that explains why you have the repression of the Muslim community. But on the other issue of the general love of liberty, well, it's a farce. You know, Republican liberty has been a farce from the very start, because it's not based on any solid philosophy. It's based on a false theory of the human being, and it's based on 18th century Enlightenment ideas, which are false ideas, and we're seeing the consequence of that now. When you get that kind of republic, eventually you have to pass laws against every fundamental liberty. So it makes a farce of the whole idea of liberty in the first place. And so we're seeing the collapse, essentially, of the principles of the French Revolution. But in the context where those principles are becoming the principles of a global government system. So, you know, France is part of a much wider agenda here. Europe and the world is going through the same process. There is a specificity in France, of course, which is the French love of liberty. But the we haven't seen any manifestation of that in the last year. If you compare France, for example, to Germany, millions of people have demonstrated against the lockdown in Germany. They demonstrated against the pseudoscience promoted by the media, and so on and so forth. There's been very little of that in France. So I think...
Why is that the case?
One of the reasons, I would say, is that the French were simply worn out from demonstrating with the Yellow Vest. I mean, you had the Yellow Vest movement just galvanized. It just, you know, mobilized thousands of people for, 2 years? It just went on and on and on and on. It went nowhere. And in a way, I think it sort of... it exhausted an awful lot of people. And then after that, with the coronavirus, they were kind of taken by surprise. But I also think it's the French are very brilliant media propagandists, and they have a much more sophisticated propaganda system than any other country I know. They are very good at preventing, preempting counter-arguments and preempting counter-movements. They do it better than most of the countries. You know, last year, you compare the Anglophone media to the French media. French have been very good at sort of at basically dividing and conquering the French elites, that is. And I think that's one of the reasons they basically, you know, you have a far-right party, sort of called far-right party, which is in bed with the Zionists, is, you know, has not really had, you know, made any significant opposition to the Macron regime in the last year. Could have had many opportunities to come out and be the hero of the people, open everything up and put the bad guys in jail. Marine Le Pen is completely sold out. And we're seeing that with a lot of the far-right parties in Europe, so-called far-right parties, that they are basically going along with the technocratic agenda. And they're not coming out on the side of the people. So that's another reason that you have extreme manipulation on the right and on the left here. And, you know, that there is no coherent view of opposition that can unite the opposition to put an end to this. Because you have to see that a lot of these agendas are linked. You know, a police state giving police almost absolute powers, and then a lockdown situation, a medical dictatorship, forced vaccination, et cetera, et cetera. They're all linked. They're all part of the takeover of society by another. You know, we need to understand that that transcends class, race, and a lot of other issues that divide people. This is what is happening is that the wealthiest people in the world have taken over the world. They've taken over pretty much every state in the world. And, okay. You know, France is an example of a country where they've done this to a very extreme extent, and they've managed to do it without much opposition until now. Because they have, they've been studying techniques of propaganda, I think, better than any other country.
Okay. And on that note, I'd like to thank my guests for being with us. We're out of time in this debate. Joining us in geopolitical analyst Gerald Coleman out of Paris and out of Marseille, independence journalist Sylvain Foucaudia.
Thank you.
Thank you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. If you have been listening to this series of shows, we are trying to talk about the last savior, Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and different doubts or misconceptions around this important topic. In recent shows, we have been trying to approach the doubts or misconceptions raised by a so-called scholar from extremist groups to make some serious doubts in the issue of occultation and in the issue of birth of Imam of the Age and different actually aspects of the life and personality and mission of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In this very show, we shall focus on the doubt that he actually made on the traditions or narrations of occultation that, based on what he says, there are some contradictions in these series of narrations. So this is what we shall discuss today with presence of Islamic scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary School. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic researcher, to this show, and we'll be asking him to answer the questions that we pose or to review whatever has been said and claimed and to have his own take on this. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to say salam to Sheikh and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam and thank you for having me. I was born in 1981 and I joined the Hausa Seminary of Qom in 1994, so it's about 25 years that I'm studying the Hausa Seminary of Qom. And beside fiqh and usul, or jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence, I have studied logic, Arabic literature and grammar, Islamic philosophy, and more importantly, Islamic theology. I also have my BA in Islamic Theology from Imam Khomeini Institute for Education and Research in Qom. And then I continued my education on monotheistic religions. I mean, I had my MA in this field from the University of Religions and Islamic Denominations. And I have my PhD in Shia Theology from University of Tehran. My PhD was about an analysis of the viewpoint of one of the false claimants with regards to the knowledge of the Imam.